Back with you again Thursday, April 14th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I talked about a controversial bill in Hartford that would, on the face of it, make some striking workers eligible for unemployment benefits. Greenwich GOP State Senator Ryan Fazio also weighed in on that same bill a little bit later in the show. We also chatted with DePaul University professor Jason Damian Hill, the author of What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Depression. This is one of those things, all right? This is one of those things when you look at it and you read it and you say to yourself, this is from The Onion, right? Or the Babylon Bee. This is a spoof, right? This can't be real. Like somebody got to all the news sites and sent out a bogus story. Some kids snuck in, some high school kids, you know, put this out on the official letterhead. Even if that, does that even exist anymore? I guess people send letters on letterhead of the state Senate here, the 36 men and women who guide the fortunes in Hartford, at least one chamber. Now, and this ties into our question of the day coming up. We always hear this from people in Hartford on both sides of the aisle, right? You and I hear this over and over again. Connecticut has to do a better job of job creation, right? We have to do a better job of telling companies, hey, at least look at Connecticut. At least look at Connecticut. We know very few of you are going to pick Connecticut as a locale. But you know what? If you're looking at other states, maybe you're not writing off the Northeast, writing off the Northeast. Take a look at Connecticut, okay, because again, we trail in job creation, and you see the numbers. I talk about them. All the other hosts around the state talk about them. They're in the news. They're in the Current and in the Hearst papers and in these smaller papers as well. You know, the Connecticut lags in this, and we lag in this, and job creation and whatever. The problem always is that there's a perception. Now, how much of this is perception versus reality? I don't know. I don't run companies. I don't look for financing and that sort of stuff. I don't, you know, pretend to know what kinds of discussions go on. But I do know when I see lunacy. And this has to do with a bill that was okay. The debate happened late yesterday while we were on the air in Hartford at the Capitol. And you and I were together talking over the issues of the day, local, state, national, whatever. And get this. This is all over the state and all the media. This is Hugh McQuaid's story in the Connecticut News Junkie. You ready for this? This is not a spoof here. This is not spoofing Connecticut, because this is who we are. And again, keep this in mind as I'm reading this and then compare and contrast. Remember that in school? Okay, boys and girls, we're going to compare and contrast things today. So compare and contrast what I'm about to read you with the other stories you always hear about. Well, there's a fading middle class in Connecticut. It's either the uber rich, the upper middle income, or people, you know, mopping floorways and halls. You know, nothing against those people, but there aren't the $40,000, $45,000, $50,000, $60,000 good blue collar manufacturing jobs in the state, because companies don't even look at that here in Connecticut. We can't compete there. And why can't we compete there? Here's a perfect example. At 2:13 on a Thursday, April 14th. Here's a perfect example. Hugh McQuaid's story in the Connecticut News Junkie. Striking workers would be eligible for unemployment benefits after 2 weeks off the job, under a bill passed along party lines after a lengthy debate Wednesday in the Connecticut Senate. I'll read that again, because you probably heard that out there and you're going, what? Huh? Striking workers, in other words, workers who have decided themselves, or they have been told by their unions, hey, we can't get a new contract, whatever, and I'm fully okay with private unions. Public unions have a problem with. Private unions, fine. Collective bargaining, okay, whatever. striking workers would be eligible for unemployment benefits after 2 weeks off the job under a bill passed along party lines after a lengthy debate Wednesday in the Connecticut State Senate. By the way, it passed 19-13. The bill was one of several controversial proposals to come out of the legislature's Labor and Public Employees Committee during this session. It would allow employees to qualify for unemployment after two consecutive weeks on strike. On strike! This is not, and look, I've collected unemployment two or three times in my life. I have no shame in that. Hey, crap happens. You know, you get fired, you get laid off. I've been at radio stations where, you know, years and years ago when the recession of 08 came down, you know, a bunch of us were fired from different stations. It happens. I collected unemployment. I scraped and scrapped and found some part-time work, worked my way back to a full-time job again. But it's not about me. So unemployment is there for an involuntary severance of the employment of an individual and the employee and the employer. Right? That's what you and I understand unemployment to be. That's why unemployment compensation, there's a fund for that. There are contributions from the employer and all that. Okay. But, you know, only in Connecticut. Honestly, when did we lose our minds here? And again, you may hear me say, well, geez, Paul, people have to eat. They have to get food on the table. I get that. I understand that. But again, how do you square, how do you justify stuff like this and then say, geez, we're having trouble getting blue-collar jobs and manufacturing jobs and union jobs in the state? You wonder why. You wonder why. I mean, this is lunacy. I'm sorry, and it is no comment on why any workers would go on strike, why there would be a breakdown between the workers and the management. That's none of my business. I don't care. But strikes happen all the time. Probably not as much as they used to, but they still do. Now, you see what they're trying to do in the bill here. They would say, well, okay, these unemployment benefits would kick in after 2 weeks. So they'll probably say, well, this would give impetus for the business to settle because this is like an axe, a guillotine hanging over their heads. Oh, geez. Ah, crap. If we don't settle this thing in 2 weeks, they're going to start collecting unemployment and then we're going to get nailed for it in the end. I mean, that's obviously the thinking here. So they're trying to walk a fine line here. But what do you think about this? I think it's nuts. And this is why Connecticut is not considered business friendly. And that's not me saying that. You go to any of these sites, in any of these business magazines or publications, CNBC, Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Motley Fool, all these places, and take a look at where Connecticut is. Now, we rank really well in somewhat smart people and people able to do a job. But when you look at, you know, business-friendly states, come on, we stink. And it's stuff like this that's done by people in the General Assembly that contributes to that. So our Facebook question of the day, facebook.com/WICC600, pretty simple. The state Senate has passed a bill allowing striking workers, they weren't laid off, they're on strike, striking workers to collect unemployment compensation. Do you support that idea? Do you like that idea? Do you think that unemployment compensation would force both sides to reconcile quickly or not? Or is this just another reason that if it weren't for the hedge fund people paying all their millions in taxes, we'd really be up the creek here in Connecticut? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Welcoming back a friend of the program, Republican State Senator Ryan Fazio, to the program to talk about this vote and other stuff going on at the Capitol, because you need to know, and that's why we're here. This vote yesterday on what people would say might be a controversial bill. Hey, even the Democrats in the majority admit that it's going to rub some people the wrong way. Ryan, it's Paul here. How are you? Good afternoon. What's up?
I'm great, Paul. I like that title, friend of the program.
Well,
that's a good one.
It's good. You know, I'm working on maybe, you know, friend of the program may get you a discount somewhere, you know, frequent flyer points, flyer miles, you know. But you're right. It sounds good if nothing else, right?
Yeah, I like the perks. Oh, the perks would be nice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Who needs American Express when you got Connecticut today? So, Ryan, listen, I'm assuming you voted no on this on the 19-13 vote, but interesting bill here. That passed the Senate that would pay unemployment benefits after 2 weeks of an organized strike here in Connecticut. Some people, though, are treading lightly on it. There's not even a guarantee it's going to be taken up in the House. Might this actually pass, Ryan, and get signed, or is this kind of a bone being thrown to organized labor? Give me your thoughts on this.
Well, I think you have to take it seriously if it passes the Senate. You have to take seriously the votes, the official votes that people are taking, the official legislative action that people are taking in our state Senate. So just to set the scene and reiterate what you articulated well, there's a bill yesterday that passed the state Senate that would make employees eligible for unemployment benefits who voluntarily choose to strike. And what is a strike by the definition of the State Department of Labor? Well, as is, it's any two employees who are engaged in a dispute with their employer for seemingly any reason. It's very difficult to see what the limitations on the rationale are. That's the existing definition, and I think it was revealed more and more clearly over the course of the floor debate, which is actually quite interesting, where we had some of our senators speaking or asking questions of the main proponent, including, you know, if there's a package store with four or six employees and two of them, you know, come to the determination that they don't like the color of the uniforms they're being forced to wear on the job or something else. Are they going to be eligible to, quote unquote, strike and then after 2 weeks collect unemployment benefits for optionally choosing to leave that employment arrangement? And by all evidentiary reason, we have to believe that the answer is yes. Now, the context of this should also be set against a Connecticut economy that's become increasingly unaffordable for people, that has failed to create jobs, that has the seventh or sixth highest unemployment rate in the country, that has lost many more jobs than, you know, 42 other states in the continental U.S. since the beginning of the of COVID, and also has some of the strictest regulations of any state in the country. So our state government needs to make it a priority to create jobs, to support small businesses, to make it more affordable for families to live in, to raise long-term wages. And bills like this are just totally unfair and unreasonable to anyone but an ideologue, and it's going to make all those things more difficult.
All right, Ryan, hang on, because you brought up some good things there, including, and we'll get back to you in just a moment, including, you know, is this limited to designated unions or not? And Ryan Fazio is the guest, back with more from him. First, traffic and weather together right here, WICC. Ryan Fazio joining us on this 19-13 vote yesterday to advance a bill that may not pass the House, but as Ryan said, it did pass the Senate, to give unemployment compensation to striking workers after 2 weeks. So, Ryan, a couple of things here as we continue. So, in the language here, this would go beyond organized, recognized unions, because that example you gave before the break of two or three people at just a corner deli or whatever, or at a small manufacturing place that's not a union shop. So this would this cover any strikers or not?
That's what it seems to be, because under the language of the bill that was passed, it says a labor dispute, employees engaged in a labor dispute. And a labor dispute by the Department of Labor is defined as any sort of disagreement with an employer consisting of two or more employees. So it does not have to be a union. I actually think it seemed that might have surprised some of my colleagues who even voted for the bill, discovering that during the floor debate. But that is what our interpretation of the bill is, and the interpretation of the Department of Labor is. And even the governor's Department of Labor commissioner has expressed very significant concern with the bill and how it would be enforced. But again, this is just another regulatory and tax policy, because ultimately this is a liability funding that would need to be financed by higher unemployment insurance taxes on small businesses, which means that they would have less money to hire people, which means that they would have less money to pay people higher wages. So it ultimately costs workers in the long run. But this is just another regulatory and tax policy among many in our state that make it very difficult to create jobs, to make it affordable to live here and offer goods and services at an affordable price, make it difficult for small businesses in particular. The big businesses have lawyers and lobbyists and accountants, but the small businesses have much more difficulty navigating the regulatory code in Connecticut. So this is, you know, just another notch in the belt of unaffordable policies from our state government. So it's very concerning, but it's also, unfortunately, not terribly new.
Yeah, and Ryan, I said earlier in the show, listen, everybody I know, including myself, and I assume you, you want fair labor negotiations, and collective bargaining is a longtime American tradition. But again, Ryan, I can imagine you have businesses who may look to set up here in Connecticut, maybe they're national businesses or looking to expand into New England or the Northeast or even local businesses. And Ryan, you're right. These are the things I think. Now, whether it comes to fruition or not, but just the fact, and I could be wrong here, Ryan, but just the fact that these are discussed, I don't know if this kind of maybe scares away the type of employer who would supply what we sorely lack here in the state, which are those blue-collar, middle-class jobs, kind of the $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year jobs that there are just not enough of here in the state.
I think both of those points are well-framed. We want fair practices and policies that benefit everybody. But I'm most concerned about the workers, about the low income, the middle income workers and families who have difficulty getting good paying jobs here or any jobs here and find it unaffordable to live here. You know, I said on the Senate floor that the Fazios come from a long line of construction workers, specifically in New York, going back generations. They're unionized. So, I want policies that help blue-collar workers, working-class people, people who are members of unions, succeed in the long run. And if you have a small business, as you point out, or a medium-sized business, and you're thinking about expanding here in Connecticut, and you see what the legislature is doing, or you see even the existing policies, you are less likely to create jobs. You are less likely to raise wages in the long run here with all these risks that are being created. So it's really going to hurt those, I think of people like my grandfather who were unionized construction workers, carpenters, it's really going to hurt those people significantly, see their wages increased in the future, to be able to get more jobs in the future, to be able to afford to live here and raise a family here.
Finally, Ryan, will this get squeamish enough, do you think, in the House in an election year where they may say, it sounds good, but not this time? What are you hearing from the House on this, if anything?
I hope so. That's my hope. I think sometimes the House, as is, might be a little less progressive than the Senate, although we're splitting hairs. So I'm hoping that is what happens. But you know, I could lose a lot of money making predictions about some of the bills that pass in Connecticut.
Ryan Fazio, Republican State Senator from Greenwich. Ryan, thanks, and we'll keep an eye on this. Take care. Have a good weekend, and we'll talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it there, Ryan Fazio. All right, so there you go. So we'll see where this goes. Yeah, now see, there's, the devil is always in the details, folks. So I went into this, and according to, you know, the printed versions of this, I'm reading on the Connecticut Mirror and on the News Junkie, and in the Current it says, well, striking workers. Well, what constitutes a strike? Does the bill say striking workers of a legally recognized union local? Or is it two full-timers at an ice cream shop? It says, well, we're on strike for more money, and we can, you know, after 2 weeks get unemployment. So it'll be interesting to see how the hairs are split on this, as we say. Break to talk about race relations, fascinating subject, past, present, and future. Our next guest is a professor of philosophy and honors distinguished faculty at DePaul University in Chicago, has written numerous books. He specializes in ethics, politics, foreign policy, and moral psychology. Name of the new book, What do white Americans owe black people? Racial justice in the age of post-oppression. And we welcome Professor Jason D. Hill to the show. Professor, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Boy, Professor, race relations, racial justice, I think vital to talk about in a relaxed and a calm way. I know that it stirs a lot of emotions, but do you think there is, Professor, a hesitancy? We'll get into your book in a moment, but are people comfortable talking about this? Yes, no, maybe, depending upon who it's with. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think people used to be more comfortable talking about it. I think there's a rather nefarious divisiveness around race relations today, where it's discussed in a very hyperbolic manner. That is, there's assumed to be more racism today than there was even during Jim Crow. And I've lived in America for 37 years now. I came here when I was 20, and I see race relations having improved markedly. And I find among the young generation, the Z generation, having been brainwashed by their radical Marxist leftist professors in the classroom, spewing rhetoric and invectives against this great republic of ours, that we are worse off. So in one sense, I think there's a disconnect between the reality of America, in which I think race relations are actually improving, and a narrative that's being spawned by a bunch of kooky left-wing nuts that would have us believe that every single person whose skin color is white is out to destroy the life world and the life plans of people who are black. So in one way, the discussion becomes very, very difficult, because unless you have to ostensibly point to reality and say, look, I can show you where it's actually increasing, where whites are less racist than they were back before the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It's people just talking past each other, I find.
The name of your book is called What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. And, you know, Professor, there are a lot of folks, primarily, as you say, on the academic and social left, who say, well, reparations, land, we don't care whether it's better now. There must be some makeup for what happened back all the way to the 1600s. What's your reaction to all that? And what does your book lay out here?
Well, I my book lays out a sort of inoculation plan, or some inoculant for both blacks and whites against this argument for reparations, because I show in the book, I think history buffs are going to love it, that the reparative moment was actually in the 1776 document and the Declaration of Independence, that this, the foundation for black freedom was forged in the crucibles of independence, or Declaration of Independence. The promise wasn't carried through. Then the second great founding of America, the Civil Rights Movement, and Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And I go into great detail between Justice Taney and Abraham Lincoln, that there were two concurrent parallel societies in America at the time of the founding, those who wanted blacks to be part of the republic, those who did not want it. The third great founding, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, granting blacks legal equality before the law, the subsequent 1972 Equal Employment Act and the affirmative action programs. I argue that reparations have been made towards blacks and that there is only so far that a free republic can go without transgressing on the rights of everyone. Actually, the 64 Civil Rights Act was a violation of private property because it told whites that you can't use your property as an extension of your living room, of yourself. I think it was a justified violation given the collusion between the states and whites and turning non-whites into actual racists. But we can't go any farther. So I argue that, you know, and I spell out in great detail how to combat these arguments. But I'll tell you what, I think the reparations movement is a very nefarious movement because what it would cost the government about $14 trillion. And it's really a stealth move to trade on white guilt and profit on every single type of black suffering, whether it's diabetes, hypertension, obesity, to advance a socialist government into place. There are many ways in which the left is trying to advance socialism, and it's using the moral argument of reparations as one way of a stealth move to advance socialism in this country.
And we'll talk about the Crown Act coming up, what that is and what the professor thinks about it. Professor, hang on. Professor Jason D. Hill, DePaul University in Chicago. What do white Americans owe black people? Racial justice in the age of post-oppression. More with Professor Hill coming up. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. 600 AM, 107.3 FM and online at WICC600.com. A few more minutes with Professor Jason D. Hill. The name of the book, What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. And, Professor, you talk about the Crown Act, which is an interesting piece of legislation, and you use this as a teachable point in what I think you're trying to put forth here. What is the Crown Act? Explain it if people haven't heard about it, and why do you think it's important?
Right. The Crown Act, which is an acronym that stands for Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair, which is a bill which was sponsored by Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. And it was in March, the U.S. House in March 18th of 2022 passed legislation that would ban race-based hair discrimination in employment and against those participating in federally assisted programs, housing programs, and public accommodations. And to go further, so the goal of the bill is to protect bias against hair texture and protective styles, including dreadlocks, cornrows, twists, braids, Bantu knots, and afros. So that's the Crown Act, right? And it's making its way through Congress. I think this is a bunch of malarkey. I think we are beyond the pale of that kind of discrimination in America. I think if this had been, you know, something that had been enacted maybe 35—I've lived in this country for 37 years, and I lived in the Deep South where people were wearing afros and cornrows. I worked in banking while I was putting myself through school. I never saw any of this. I think maybe 50, 60 years ago, it might have been necessary. We're beyond the pale of that discrimination. There might be some isolated incidents, but to turn those isolated incidents into a national catastrophe is hyperbolic. So I think this is one way in which the left tries to create, again, you know, sort of inflate the degree or the perception of racism that exists out there in the world to create an artificial divide between the races. This is the Crown Act is one example.
How much
and
of
I,
a?
You know, I wrote this article in the.
No, I'm sorry, Professor. Go ahead.
No, I wrote this article in the Hill where I tried to explain how it was a violation of property rights, And it's it goes against also the right of businesses to legislate a dress code under which, uncombed, ungroomed hair could fall under. This has nothing to do with hairstyle or hair texture. This has simply to do with looking well-groomed and looking well and polished as an employee of a company. And it goes against the rights of property owners to regulate and have a dress code. We can't turn up in work in our flip-flops and our T-shirts and say, mm-hmm. this is who I am. Right. So, yeah.
How much damage, Professor Hill? How much damage do you think the tragic death of George Floyd left on this country or created? Look, it's tragic that he died, but I point out, Professor, on this program over and over, that this was done by a rogue cop who had had numerous complaints against him, probably should not have been on the street. And the Minneapolis Police Department, was not known as a very competent or clean department. Yet this one case, Professor, as tragic as it was for everyone in his family and George Floyd's family and friends, somehow was turned into, I think, this tremendous wedge to say, look, everything and everyone is racist. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Derek Chauvin, of course, as you said, was a rogue cop. What happened was tragic. But the nihilistic looting and rioting of both, incidentally, black businesses, and the thousands of black businesses that were destroyed across this country through vandalism and rioting and burn and arson, are acts of nihilism. They go beyond the pale of expressed anger and righteous indignation. There are proper ways, such as peaceful demonstrations, that we saw during the civil rights and that we have seen in past cases when we have witnessed acts of injustices inflicted against people. These organizations and the participants who engaged in these riotings and these acts of vandalism and theft are the products of a nihilistic culture and the products of and the whole defund the police movement that followed, which I think is one of the most nefarious suggestions that we can and gestures and enactments that we can have in our country, where law enforcement, which is the agency that protects our inalienable individual rights, is defunded, speaks more to the nihilistic tendencies of this country and some of its citizens than to any legitimate expression of outrage against the tragic death of one individual at the hand of a police officer who is not, I'm radically pro-blue, pro-police officers for obvious reasons, who is not representative of the majority of hardworking, decent, black, white, Hispanic, Asian police officers in this country.
Professor Jason D. Hill, he's at DePaul University. Name of the book, What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Depression. Professor, thank you for the time. It's fascinating. Good luck with the book. And, of course, folks can pick it up at Amazon or wherever they buy books. And hopefully we can talk down the road. Professor, thank you. Good luck.
Thanks, Paul. It was a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Name of the book, folks, What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression, DePaul University Professor Jason D. Hill. He's got about five other books as well. Check it out, Amazon.com, or, as they say, wherever you buy your books.